amount of time as they need.
Well, know where I'm writing stuff, because I'm just I am just me. No, they can visit us.
Hello and welcome to episode 214 of the Rockstar CMO Effing Marketing Podcast. It's Saturday the 20th of April. I hope you had a good week and you're staying as sane as you feel you need to be. I'm your host, Ian Truscott. I'm not a rock star, but I am a CMO and trusted marketing advisor. And on this podcast, with the help of my chums, we share marketing street knowledge to inspire your inner rock star. Come say hello. You can find links to me and my guests in the show notes at rockstarcmo.com or on LinkedIn at rockstarcmo. And we are proud members of the Marketing Podcast Network. As you know, my normal sidekick, Jeff Clark, is away for a few weeks. So this week is just me sharing five thoughts for the week. But I'm not alone, as in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar, Robert Rose finds himself in the typing pool. But first, we need to pay the bar tab. I'll be back in a moment.
We'll be right back.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Heiler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Right, let's get started with five effing thoughts from me inspired by my week. This week, I'm giving something new a go. With Jeff away, I'm going to share five effing thoughts for the week. The first of those thoughts is a bit of a cheat, as I thought I'd share a bit about what I'm doing now as I'm trying something new. There are many interview-style podcasts, and as you've probably noticed, I've kind of changed a little bit, and we're doing fewer interviews on the show, and I stick to my regulars, Robert and Jeff, these days. The reason why I wanted to do that is because I wanted to manage the length of the podcast. It was getting a little bit long. I didn't want to go over an hour. And yet I still wanted to dig into the detailed topics that me and Jeff tend to discuss. So therefore, I kind of knocked out one of the sections of the podcast, which was the guest section. So I still have Jeff and Robert. So now Jeff is away for a week. And so I thought I'd try something that I've seen a lot of the podcasts, or heard rather, a lot of the podcasts that I've listened to do really well. For example, Seth Godin's Akimbo podcast, where he just does a monologue for 20 minutes. And I've heard that this is quite a difficult thing to do. So I thought I'd try it. And I've done some short bits on the podcast before, but this is the first time I'm going to try doing like a 20 minute set or so on my own. So bear with me on this. So I'm giving it a go. And I hope you like it. So that's my first thought. This is what I'm doing. And this is a little bit about the history of the podcast. My second thought is about people that ask you if they can pick your brain. Now, I've seen a lot of this on the socials where people like me, advisors or consultants, they sort of complain and say that, you know, your network shouldn't ask to pick your brains. You're basically asking for free consulting. Would you, for example, ask a plumber, if you had a chum who's a plumber, to pop round and do a little bit of work for free, or a dentist, or your accountant, or any other professional? You wouldn't, would you? You would enter into a contract with them and then you'd pay them to do the work. But I'm kind of quite open to this. So I had a chat with an old sales colleague the other day, and it was one of those can I pick your brains free consulting gigs. And I would encourage you to do that if you're a consultant, if you're an advisor, but it has to be done very carefully, because I think that these pick your brain sessions can lead to something more. Even if it's just an excuse to chat with a chum, keep the networking heart beating, or there might be a bit of quid pro quo in it, because you know, they talk about in marketing, the psychology of marketing, that if you can, there's the law of reciprocity. I'm going to struggle with that. But it, basically, if you give something to somebody, they're more likely to give you something back. So if you do somebody a favor with a pick your brains, you've got a kind of favor in the bank with them. So you can go to them and ask them for something in return, perhaps. But there's also, I think, a good opportunity for it to lead to something more. So if you help somebody out, they're bound to, if you can't help them directly, they'll then refer you to somebody else. And I've had this actually happen to me quite successfully, is that somebody's asked to pick my brains, and it actually turned into a much bigger opportunity. But I think I can understand exactly where folks are coming from, where they talk about plumbers and dentists, and they say, you know, you should avoid these kind of pick your brains conversations if you are a freelance consultant. But I think the way to manage it is to really draw a line around when something becomes a paid engagement, and also that both parties understand the value of the advice. One of the dangers of helping people for nothing is that the value of it to them is nothing, right? So you need to make sure that they understand that what they're getting has a bigger value, particularly if it does turn into a paid engagement and they're not surprised by, oh, that's your day rate. Yes, yes, it is. So when someone asks to pick my brains, I'm more than happy to help. I've written about this on my personal blog, and I'll include a link to that in the show notes as well. So my next thought is actually related to the conversation I was just referring to. So an old sales colleague got in touch with me, and they were struggling with something from a marketing perspective, and they wanted my advice. So I jumped on a call with them. And the advice they wanted is, they couldn't quite understand why people weren't filling in their forms. So they'd done a lot of work around building up their list and communicating to these people. And they were running what on the surface would appear to be very successful campaigns. They're new in market with a new startup product. A lot of people were responding to their campaigns, responding to the CTA in order to go onto the website. But they couldn't understand what was happening then. Why was there such a drop off at the end? And you've probably seen it too. I mean, this is a popular, you know, this is a standard, rather than popular, a standard kind of campaign you might run in B2B, is that you're going to try and drive traffic to a landing page. And that call to action is to get in touch or request a demo. You've seen those sorts of things. You know what they're like. So why is it that these folks weren't responding to the campaign in the way that this company thought they should, right? They've put out the bait, they've talked about what they do, and then people are coming to the form, but they're not filling it in. Now, I don't know this business particularly in detail, and that's one of the things you've got to be careful about with a pick your brains type session, is that often you might be asked to answer a question that really needs perhaps a little bit more discovery and a little bit more work, and a bit more work than what you can really put into a pick my brains session. But what it was clear to me was that this was a company that was a startup. They're new in market. They're new in the category. It's a new category. And so there's an awful lot of education that needs to happen around that. So clearly people are responding to the campaign because they're interested, but they're not so interested yet that they would actually give you their contact details, or they're not ready for a demo, or whatever the offer is on that page. So I think the first thing to think about if you're facing this problem is to optimize that page. And when I've seen this in the past, it's often actually the landing page that's the challenge. It's too complicated. There's too many things on it. It doesn't clearly articulate what the value is, what's going to happen if they fill in the form. Or maybe the form's too long and all the fields are mandatory and you've got to put in your sort of wife's maiden name and all that kind of crap, when actually all you need is their contact details so you can continue the conversation. So some of the answer to that, and some of the advice that I would give on something like this, is to optimize the page. But I think what the situation was here, which is what I encouraged them to look at, was I just don't think the audience was warm enough to fill in a form. So what do you do in that situation? Well, it could be that what you need to look at is, what's the behavior happening when they land on the form? Are they bouncing right off and you've kind of turned them right off? Or maybe if their actual intent is actually for some education, they're actually landing on the form page. They're not filling in the form, but they're going around the website and looking for other stuff. Now, if that seems to be the case, then maybe add other options to that page or to the call to action, and allow them to learn more and then to come back to the call to action, come back to the page later on when they're a little bit warmer and they're ready to commit, right? When they're ready to maybe it's about trust, and I'll talk about trust in a bit. And when they trust you enough, they're going to give you their contact details. The other thing about this particular startup that I was chatting to my chum was that as a startup, a very, very light website. So very little actually to get them warmed up if somebody did land on the campaign. So you can imagine, you see something on LinkedIn, you think, that sounds interesting. You click through and there isn't anything else. And really, you might be the target market, you might be the ICP, you might be the right persona, but you're not at that point motivated to fill in the form. So I would say something like that, and to try and figure out the intent. And the other thing that I encouraged them to do was to look at the behavior when somebody landed on the form. What were they clicking on? What were they doing? Were they bouncing right away? As I mentioned just a moment ago, and you can do some lots of testing with this for things like Microsoft Clarity or Hotjar or something like that, and actually see the activity that people are doing on that page. So I know this is a little bit different to the sort of advice I normally give on this podcast. Normally we'll talk about strategy and stuff, but sometimes the rubber hits the road, and this was the advice I was being asked to give. So the advice really there is to trust the audience a little more. Don't just hit them with the contact form straight away, and let them choose their own adventure, and let them choose when they're going to come and engage with you. So that's my thought number three. So far, I've suggested that people you allow people to pick your brains, and then in doing that, I've then had this conversation where why aren't people filling in their forms? Thought number four is, again, related to some client work that I've been doing. And I got asked to get involved with a messaging project, right? So the client, they know my background, they know the industry that I'm in, and they were working on a messaging project and had been working on it for some time, and said, can you take a look at this for me? I want to figure out, you know, where's it going wrong? What's happening? Is this looking good? And all that kind of stuff. So I spent a few weeks with them, helping them, getting it back on track. And right now the project has recovered and it's looking good. But in retrospect, I think I may have made a mistake, as I think the challenge for them may be in a bit more fundamental. And maybe I should have been a bit firmer with some of the advice and taken a step back, and maybe the project might have recovered a bit quicker than the few weeks it took for us to discuss it. And let me explain that. So if you're a regular listener, you'll know that when Jeff and I approach just about any topic, we consistently, probably to the point of sounding a bit boring to you, maybe, we talk about goals and objectives. It's always about goals and objectives with us. And there's an important reason for that, particularly when you're laddering up to the C-suite and what somebody really cares about at that sort of top level. If you don't have that captured, then somewhere down the line, this project is probably going to fail, or it'll get starved of oxygen or starved of budget, or something will happen and your project will fail. You need to make sure that you have that. And it's all of that stuff isn't just tied to what you think is important as a marketer, but it's also tied to the company objectives and what's important for the executive team. Again, we bang on about this every week, so I'm sure you've heard this before. However, when Jeff and I chat, and while we have a loads of experience, we're often talking slightly theoretically, and often from the point of view that we're working in a green field, that we're starting something new. So we're often talking about what should a CMO look for in a new gig, or we're talking about a new content marketing strategy or something like that. And really, the truth of that is we're not always starting or building new things as marketing leaders. We're often inheriting projects. And the temptation is always to make that work. It's that phrase of I'm building the plane while it's flying, right? So you start to apply your experience and you start applying duct tape and you keep the plane flying and everything's going to be good. But I think what I learned from this project is, maybe take a moment. If somebody asks you to help with something like this, maybe you're an external like myself, or maybe it's a project that comes your way as a marketing leader, or you've started a new role and there's something in play, really take a step back and think about make sure the foundations of that project are sound and you know why you're doing it and what it's for. And I think those two things are really important. And often I talk about asking why when we start something new, but I think that we need to constantly be asking why with a project, because what had happened with this messaging project, it had kind of drifted. And I think what had happened really was the team had lost sight of the original brief and why it was for and who the presentation was for. Was it an internal audience? Was it sales enablement? Was it to inform a content marketing strategy? And so really, I don't think any of the kind of key stakeholders really had that same vision about what this project was for. And so if you assume that a project is for something and will be presented in a certain way, or that it's for a certain audience, you're gonna structure that project in that way. But if you're off, then one of the other stakeholders is going to say, this isn't what I'm looking for. This isn't for me. So we need to make sure that you understand what the goals and objectives are of any project right at the beginning, but also keep checking back into them. And that may sound kind of fundamental. And I must admit that I think maybe we're boring you sometimes when me and Jeff talk about this so much. But I've had recent experience where I think I actually needed that reminder. You know, I needed to be reminded that take the pain, go back a step, think about it a little bit first, then go forward. And actually, that's going to be way quicker than spending a few weeks sort of trying to apply duct tape and band-aids and elastoplast over something when actually fundamentally the project is flawed. So that's my thought number four, is make sure whatever you're working on, whether it's a new project or something that's going along, is understand what it's for. My last thought number five, is about trust. And as I mentioned, I've been doing a lot of messaging work recently with different clients, and doing that, we discover their ICP, their ideal customer profile, and buyers and influencer personas. And often these personas, and also the sort of standard way of building personas B2B, is to think about pains or problems that need to be solved and the tasks that need to be done, right? So you're thinking about your persona, you're thinking about your marketing leader or whoever it is you sell to, and you're thinking about, what is it the job they need to get done, what tasks they need to do, and what problems need to be solved? Now, I tend to kind of not go down that level of detail so much. I think it's a great approach, but in my experience, it tends to narrow the conversation down to solving these problems with features and functions. And I think that if you're creating these personas with the view to creating distinct or differentiated messaging, if you then start to drive down this path where you're actually thinking about features and functions, it's going to be very hard to reverse out of that and then think about thought leadership and something more emotional that maybe that persona may care about some more. And also, dare I say it, sometimes the opposite happens. So if you have an established product and you're working with a team and they all know the features and functions, they're kind of trying to retrofit the pains and tasks to the features of the product. So you ask them, what are people trying to achieve with this product? They will tell you all the tasks that I help to get done by the features and functions of the product. It's almost like a kind of marketing post-rationalization, I suppose you could say. But for me, absolutely. When I was a product owner or product manager, and that's my background, I have a dev background, then yes, please, to use a personas that are very focused on the task to be done. I want to know exactly what's trying to be achieved and how it's to be achieved and what the problems are with that and what the broader picture is. I'd like as much detail as possible, please. But right now, I don't, because I'm a marketer. And as a marketer, and as you probably know as a listener, and or if you've read any of my stuff, you know that my marketing mantra is that we're here to create awareness, revenue, and trust. And again, in the last thought, I was thinking about how we might bore you by talking about goals and objectives. I'd probably bore you by talking about awareness, revenue, and trust every week. But that's my mantra, is to create art, awareness, revenue, and trust. And of course, revenue is the most important thing that the business needs. But nobody can buy a product if they're not aware of it. And they won't risk their success or their credibility on companies they don't trust. So that's why I think that awareness, revenue, and trust are important. And as you can see there, when I said it, with revenue so important, and I share this so often, is that, you know, often the CEO or the C-suite, they would prefer it if my acronym was RAT, because revenue is so key. But anyway, let me get back on track. So sure, back onto building our personas, and we're thinking about features and functions. And sure, having a great product, lots of features and functions, builds trust. But I think the buyer doesn't really have time to figure all that out in the first pass of the market. If you're in a crowded category and you've got all of your competitors all chirping away the same kind of stuff about features and functions, it's going to be very hard for them to discern one competitor from the other. right? And they don't have the time necessarily to go into the level of depth to understand about how your way of solving their problem is slightly different or much better than your competitors, right? They need to sort of figure you out fairly early on and be distinct. It's also something I've talked about on my Tuesday Two Cents regular articles that I publish on LinkedIn and on my blog as well. So you need to try and figure out how to be distinct. And the sort of what you're trying to do there with this messaging is you're actually trying to open the door to allow them to create enough trust that they'll have a conversation with you so you can explore the features, tell the product stories, dive into all these benefits and all these functions. And therefore, you're in this process of building trust to enable the next stage. So hitting them with features and functions early doors isn't necessarily going to help you. What you want to do is as a marketer, is to light the blue touch paper and get that conversation going. And so you're building trust. And as any good content marketer will tell you, nothing builds trust better than being useful. So when building personas for messaging and content strategy, so not for the product owners and stuff, I tend to need nuggets that can develop into something useful that will make us trustworthy or make us trusted. So I prefer to think more broadly about their needs and aspirations rather than the narrow approach of pains or jobs to be done that can be solved with a tick box feature list, right? So I'm thinking about what are they actually trying to achieve maybe in their day or in their job or whatever it is, right? So something a bit broader. And also, what are the challenges that they have today? And one of those challenges could be that this is the first time they've purchased any software, so or particularly a B2B enterprise level. So, and that's the task they need to get done. So how do we help them make the choice? How do we make that? How do we help them choose? And I think that so we're sort of building up this trust and we need to provide these useful assets. And the only way we're going to be useful is if we understand their needs and aspirations. We're not going to be useful if we understand the job they want to be done, because we already kind of know that because we built the product. And actually, this got me thinking more deeply again about trust. And so what I think here is that when we're building our personas, maybe there's a simple question we need to ask in the personas. What can we do to encourage this persona to trust us? So if you think about when you're building a persona, and I'm assuming that you've tried this and you've done it, right, is that normally we list out, you know, what their job titles could be, what their what their role is in the buying process, what their needs are, what their jobs to be done are. But how about just having one question, maybe have all of that stuff and have this question, is what can we do to encourage this persona to trust us? And we do that because if they trust us, then we'll move further down the customer journey. We'll move to the next stage. They will then more likely purchase from us. So that's my final thought of my five thoughts, is what can we do to encourage this persona to trust us? That's it. That's my five effing thoughts for this week. Please let me know what you think of my attempt at a monologue. Have I channeled my inner Seth Godin? Or what do you think of any of these thoughts? Or maybe suggest something I should dig into. You know where to find me, ian@rockstarcmo.com, or you can find us on LinkedIn. I'm Ian Truscott, of course. And of course, as is customary for this podcast, I need to choose a song. And I'm going to go back to something I've used on the show before, the classic track Think by Lynn Collins. But this is the cover from reggae dancehall star Patra from 1993. Tiny bit of Patra and Lynn Collins there, and don't worry, I haven't run out of friends. I was just wondering if the world needs another effing marketing interview show. I will give it another go next week, and if I can share anything that might be useful to you, please let me know. Right, that's quite enough of me. It's that time of the week to wind down the Rockstar CMO virtual bar and join the chief troublemaker of the content advisory, Robert Rose, for a cocktail and a marketing thought. Good evening, Robert. What are you drinking?
Well, hello, my friend. Wow, I see you have gone completely old school here, a typing pool. This is like, you know, yeah. I mean, I know you were trying to sort of, the sort of legacy old school of AI of you know, thousands of people typing all into it, but a typing pool is really, I mean, there's so much typing going on here. It's, you know, it's quite the office. I don't know what you're making here, but you're clearly documenting something.
It's exactly what you were saying. If enough people type enough stuff, I'm coming up with the next version of ChatGPT.
I see. There you go.
You put in a prompt, and we'll have the words.
It's Bar GPT. Yeah, there you go. Okay.
I wish I'd have said that. That's brilliant. Welcome to Bar GPT.
Bar GPT. where you too can type anything into a typewriter and have it be genius.
Absolutely. I'm preparing for the end of the world, mate, because I think that this will be the only way that intelligence will be shared through the typed written word.
Oh, I see. Yes, there you go. So I'll take it. It's very highly secure stuff. Highly secure documents.
Yeah. It's because your channel on your podcast, Joe Polizzi, is threatening to move to Wyoming, isn't he? Bury himself.
Yeah, he's deathly afraid of the whole technology thing. Yeah.
So I'm preparing for that. See, I'm going to write all the books for you and Joe.
There you go. I like it.
So let's let these guys, this typing die down.
Yeah, the typing away. So we have a fun drink here, mm-hmm. and it's definitely built for the warm spring days and coming out of work. Because sometimes we feel like we've been in a boiler room selling and marketing and doing our jobs and typing away at all the things. And this is the name of this cocktail is called The Boiler Room.
Oh.
And it's a little bit of a complex cocktail. It's it's almost like a tea, if you will. Because what you've got is you start with bourbon, one part bourbon, and then you add a half a part of a ginger liqueur. If you can find such a thing, Domaine de Canton is a great one. It's a French liqueur, and it's ginger in flavor. Then you add a little bit of marigold tea. You can add really any kind of tea here, not a black tea, but some sort of floral or herbal tea that you like. Mm-hmm. Marigold has got sort of a light, very light taste, so that's right. what I like that. Mm-hmm. And then a little lemon juice, and then a little honey, like maybe a half part of honey. And then here's the sort of thing that sort of tops it all off is three parts of a wheat beer. So you can go with a Belgian style wheat beer, or you know any of the wheat beers that you. So you want very light beer, basically a very light. Chilled beer. Put that in. So you've got bourbon and beer and the liqueur and mix all that stuff up together into a glass. You know, you can put it into a pitcher if you want, or just make it into a single serving, if you will. And then you've got a very lovely, cold, refreshing, what we call a boiler room.
Well, I'm curious. You know that there are some inventions where you think, how the hell did somebody come up with that? That is a curious bunch of ingredients. Was that invented by yourself or was that something you came across?
No, it's something I found actually because it was funny because I was sort of looking at to riff off of the classic Boilermaker, right? So you basically have Boilermaker is just basically a beer with a shot of whiskey poured into it.
Yes.
And I've never really enjoyed that very much.
No.
But this was actually lovely because there's enough other stuff in it that it actually sort of takes everything out of it. And because you're using a wheat beer, the whiskey comes through better than it does otherwise.
Nice. Well, I don't know where I'm going to get marigold tea or a ginger liqueur, but that sounds fantastic.
Right?
So where would one sip the boiler rooms?
I think we got to find a game somewhere. I mean, this feels like a Saturday morning sort of thing where we sit and get in preparation for a game that we're going to. So some bar near the stadium
where we're going to go see somebody play that we like, and we're going to have a couple of these to get us well lubricated for the game.
I like that idea. I like that idea. And when conversation, I know that we'll be very focused on the game, and presumably we'll be saying your beloved Cowboys or some, or my Chelsea. But when conversation turns to marketing, what are we chatting about this week?
So I was thinking about B2B content and technology companies for the most part, you know, especially enterprise types of selling and marketing. And you know, we were talking, I was talking with someone not too long ago about, and they work for a B2B technology firm, enterprise, selling enterprise products. And we were talking about the how the buyer's journey is obviously more complicated these days. You know, it's mostly committee-based. You know, there's typically four or five people on a committee that are that have been assigned to do their research. And a lot of them have been, you know, designated research of X or Y. And the interesting thing to me is when we start thinking about differentiation in today's B2B enterprise sale, we're really not thinking about differentiating with content on Google any longer, because that's almost the price of admission. What we really need to be doing is differentiating on the, and this and research shows us out that that buying committee is going to probably assemble 40 to 50 pieces of content that they use help short get them to a short list of possible solutions. So it's not differentiating in Google, which is, you know, going to be basically easy enough, right? If we're in a long considered sales cycle, it's likely that the number of competitors in our space, if they're in the right space, are probably pretty few, right? We're talking, you know, less than a handful of companies that can that can actually do what we do for our particular buyers. However, they're going to be assembling content from all of those companies, right? From whether there's 9 or 10 or 12 or 6 or however many. And so they're going to get 50. So we have to differentiate in that. And so the way that we've been doing that in B2B anyway is creating more, right? So we just need to create more and more and more and more content, because if you create more and more content, then the chances are that your content's going to be in that pile, in a slightly bigger pile than anybody else's. And so your content will get there. But the problem is that you end up with more and more and more, you create more and more commoditized stuff, right? Because again, in a long sales cycle process at the enterprise level, let's just be honest with ourselves. There's a right way to do this and a wrong way to do this. And hopefully we're on the right side of things, right, in our industry. But so is our competitor. Our competitor isn't stupid. They might be suggesting a different way, but it's not a different way and a different kind of approach. It's basically the same way that we're providing it, but we just use different words and we use different, you know, it's there's a right way to do things, right? And we all know what that right way to do things are. And we're trying to differentiate within that sort of correct or proper way of facilitating that change. So how do you differentiate there without just creating scads of more? And so one of the things that I've often talked about is, okay, well, for content teams, for marketing teams, how much content should you create? And, you know, we've talked about this on this show before. My old answer to that was, well, you create as much content as you can be great at, like as much as you can be really awesome at. And of course, that's wrong. And I've talked about it on this show before how that's wrong. And the question is rather, how little can you create to differentiate and create the impact you're trying to create? So it's not that more is enough. It's enough is enough. You need to know when you're creating enough content. And the only way to do that is to actually look at the content you're creating and get out of the mentality of what it need, what form factor it needs to fit into in order to be different. And I'll give you an example of this, right? Whenever I talk to a content team or a marketing team, and this is especially true in B2B businesses, technology businesses, I'll say, tell me about your content calendar. Well, we're going to create, let's say, 6, you know, research papers or 6 articles or 6 blog posts across the next 6 months or 6 webinars or whatever, right? It's like, okay, tell me what that is. Well, it's, you know, for webinars, they're each 1 hour long, you know, videos with a guest. Okay. this article, you know, well, all of our blog posts are 1200 words or 1500 words and they're, you know, they fit this format. Or these research papers, they're, you know, 2500 to 5000 words and they, you know, they look like our template. It's like, okay, maybe that's right. But instead, what if you looked at those four blog posts or those four webinars and instead of saying, I need to write four articles of 1500 words each, well, what if we just said, we need to tell the story that we want to tell? Like, what if we need to, you know, we want to create the topic or the content that we want to create? Maybe one of those blog posts is 500 words. Maybe one of those blog posts is going to be 4,000 words. And instead of getting so wrapped around the axle of format, let's figure out the right length for the impactful content we want to create and plan for that. Then figure out if we need to change the container that it's going to be in so that we can actually differentiate. So that we're differentiating on ideas, not the sort of standard format of content formats that seem to be so prevalent in the recommendations. You know, how many times have you seen like, oh, well, if you're creating top of the funnel B2B, you know, long form content, well, it needs to be a research paper, it needs to be a white paper, it needs to be an ebook or whatever. And instead, it doesn't. It can be something. So start thinking about how we differentiate on our ideas, no matter what the length is going to be, and focusing on the impact. That way, if it's a paper, it might be an article, it might be a PDF file, but it might only be 500 words. And it might have, that might be all it needs. Or it might be a blog post and it might be three videos plus a, you know, how to plus a, you know, it might be a whole bunch of things. We got to really start focusing in on the ideas, no matter what their length and the impact, rather than trying to shoehorn everything into these sort of standardized quote unquote formats that have become so commoditized and popular.
Hallelujah, brother. And the other thing is you say shoehorn, but also could be the opposite. It's like some books you read where this could have been a blog post, you know, so
totally point, that's a great point. Example. Business books are the key, right? You read a business book and at the end of it, you're like, Jesus, did it? I mean, that could have been told in 4 pages. I don't know why.
Well, also, how many people do you talk to about business books, about how many they don't finish? They're like, well, I got it within the first third of this book and the rest of it is just repetition. And I think that that's the same, is an idea, it warrants its own vessel. You know what I mean? And sometimes that's going to be a small vessel and sometimes that's going to be a big thing. Like you say, it's going to be a webinar plus an ebook plus three blog posts plus everything else because it's got some heft. Whereas another idea might just be, oh, it's just a quick blog post. This is the idea and that's it.
I love that.
The other thing as well, when you're talking about differentiation, I wrote a little bit about this on my Tuesday Two Cents, is how you tell your story like that. If you give, I would imagine that would differentiate you, right? If you let the idea rule the format and how much time you spend on it, that's going to be very different from your competitors. If all, you know, that pile of, that digital pile of content they've got in front of them, they're all 2,500 word white papers, and you pop in with an ebook that's like, bam, or you pop in with a really thoughtful thought leadership piece that is genuinely thought leadership, it's going to stand out, isn't it?
That's exactly right. I mean, what you're trying to do is pierce the noise with ideas, not formats, right? And so something unexpected there can be just as impactful, right? You know, I mean, here's an example of that. So it was the wrong targeting, but I had a company reach out to me, a software company reach out to me, and they reached out to me with a video instead of an email, right? It was literally like, hey, here's a 3-minute video made for you, personally for you. And it was well done and it was well produced. But it was clearly like, you know, they referenced me by name. They knew they had read my LinkedIn profile. They knew a little bit about me. They knew some of what I had written. And they were, you know, and it got my attention, right? It pierced the noise. And when they started talking about their approach, right, their thought leadership, I was listening because it was not something I had seen. So I took the time to actually listen and comprehend it. Not because of the, you know, not because it was a standard format of a video, but because of the ideas contained in it. But it was outside, it was exactly as long and in exactly the format it needed to be in for the kind of message they were trying to get, right?
Yeah, that sounds cool. I mean, I wish that I wish people would reach out to me with emails that are as well crafted as that, let alone put a video together. That sounds fantastic. So Robert, where are people going to find ideas that have been given enough or a short amount of time as they need?
Well, nowhere I'm writing stuff because I am just me. No, they can visit our website at contentadvisory.net. And of course, I'm writing on Content Marketing Institute's website as well.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Your rose-colored glasses articles,
that's indeed.
Which I often actually link to in our newsletter and in the show notes, because often what you discuss here, you discuss in much more length there. And I think it's great that people go to those companion pieces and get the details. So that's fantastic. So I'll include links to that in the show notes as well. And when people spin the dial on the interwebs, where are they going to find you, mate?
They'll find me on LinkedIn mostly, yeah.
Excellent. And will I find you in the bar next week?
Oh, of course you will, yeah.
I look forward to that. I'll see you then, mate. Thank you, Robert. And another thing to plug for the Content Advisory. As Kathy mentioned last week, they have a webinar coming up on Thursday, and I'll include a link to that also in the show notes. So that's a wrap on episode 214 of the Rockstar CMO Effing Marketing Podcast. I've been your host, Ian Truscott. You can find links to me, Robert, and all the things we discussed in the show notes on rockstarcmo.com, along with our blog, newsletter, and all of our previous episodes. And thank you for dropping a dime into your podcasting jukebox, selecting our track and jiving along with us. I'd love to hear from you, so please say hello or drop a rating or review in your favourite podcast app, or just keep listening. I'm glad you're here. Next week, more of the same with 5 effing thoughts from me, and Robert will keep me company in the virtual bar with his weekly marketing thought. Until then, have a great week. I hope you get again. Join us here next week on Rockstar CMO FM.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.